And off we go with our fourth show, Hagen. How do you feel about the fourth show?
We're doing the fourth show in English.
In English, yeah.
Okay, let's do that.
It's the second English show.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, the first four shows have been awesome. It's a great history. It's a remarkable achievement in podcasting.
Yeah, I was wondering if Obama will call, but he didn't. So
you never know. He's pretty busy these days.
Yeah,
you're maybe.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I thought that last time our English was perfect.
Yeah, remarkable or flawless. Both.
Yeah, flawless. Let's go with flawless.
Okay. I choose English today because I think I'm a better person in English than in German.
Because you cannot swear and complain too much.
I cannot swear and complain too much, right. I don't know.
Yeah, what have you been doing today? This week?
This week? I was at Buzzwords, Berlin Buzzwords. It's a conference in, I don't know, maybe the millionth episode or something. So it's been there forever. 2009? 2010? I don't know really. Important. But this is a Berlin conference organized by some people from the open source community, from Apache, and some from Elasticsearch, and some from Solr, and it's all about buzzwords, I guess. But then the main focus seems to be NoSQL solutions, data processing stuff, and a bit scientific stuff is also there. And they what's kind of nice, but not always really accurate, is they label their talks in beginner, intermediate, and advanced. So you get to choose, like you can choose, okay, I have no idea about stream processing. I will take the entrance level beginner's talks and don't
and
go
how did
for
it
the
work out?
This year not so well. I was on advanced talks, or like for instance, there was a Docker talk. Elasticsearch, running Elasticsearch with Docker, and it's supposed to be intermediate, but it was like basic, like really trivial stuff.
Okay.
But then, knowing this, I'm working with Docker now also like 1.5, 2 years. And then maybe it's like it's relative because you're it's relative to your skill set. So other stuff like, I don't know, a key value store, for instance, that works with finite state transducers written in C++ was advanced and I didn't understand anything.
So then the name was right.
Yeah, it was right. But I think it's always relative and it's kind of hard. Yeah, like sure. That's always, you can get lucky and you can waste some time on these conferences. But I want to give a short overview about...
Yeah, but
like the first day was really nice, and the second day I was kind of lazy because I got drunk the day before that, and so I didn't write so much down.
Wrote.
Oh, flaky English.
But maybe it's not right what I said.
But I don't want to start right away. How do you feel about the election in the USA? Are you happy with, like, Trump won?
I thought we are an IT podcast.
Yeah, but I think it's interesting to think about that.
Yeah. Well, how was the first day?
I think Trump will make it.
make America greater again?
Yeah, I'm all for
or
Trump.
Great again?
Yeah, I'm like, because I'm a racist and...
Oh, come on. You know...
Yeah, maybe.
That's, okay. That's, this podcast is heard all around the world.
And me saying I'm a racist
the planet
is...
You just... Just
maybe some people aren't like open-minded and get some of these
but
jokes.
You cannot convey the German humor in English. That's
okay.
Why you are more polite. And now you contradict what you just said. Like, I'm more polite and then you're open with...
I am polite. I don't want to like... I care for the US people. Really. I want to have... Like,
yeah, I know.
Yeah. It should be great again, though.
experiment. Okay. All to the gutter now. I mean, we wanted to talk in English to not make so much weird jokes, but that didn't
okay,
work
so,
out so good. Buzzwords.
I started off with joining a talk about probabilistic data structure because, first of all, the week before Buzzwords, so last week, I actually caught up on implementing a heavy hitter algorithm with Kafka.
What is a heavy hitter algorithm?
Yeah, a heavy hitter algorithm is like a conjunction or like you use a count min sketch data structure. I will explain that. And another hash map to it. So you get always like you measure what's like the top. You look at a stream and you get the top K items from the stream in a certain time window. So that's the heavy hitter. So you look at a stream and you say, for the last 10 seconds, which item did I see the most?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't actually count everything one by one, but instead you use a table of hash functions. Oh no, you use a table structure where you hash with multiple hash functions. And then you place the item in a table for the first hash function, for the second, and you can trade like hash functions for speed, and you can trade size of the table for precision.
Yeah, to make a weird example, let's say you have a hash function that creates a certain hash according to the place where you're living, and then you just apply this hash functions to people, and they will be in the same bucket when they live in the same place.
It's a bit different. And
why?
It to explain like how the hash functions. Do you actually want to have weak hash functions?
Yeah, sure. But the hash function I just said it's weak. It's like.
Well, yeah, but if you have a hash function, then hash is latitude and longitude, and you have a hash function that goes Johann Meyer Straße and ends up in the same, that would be a bit weird, actually.
No, it's just Berlin is the hash output is 5, and Hamburg is 3. And if I do my hash function on you, because you live in Berlin now, it's 5, and I live in Berlin, so my output is also 5. But someone in the outskirts of even farther away than you in the outskirts of Berlin, he got maybe also a 5, which is not really precise, but it's just
it's like collision matters, like we can say that. So you want to have actually like a small range of values that your hash function is outputting. So the important part of probabilistic data structure is like you can have a predictable accuracy. So you can give like how, like there he was like introducing this one library from ClearSpring Streams. It's a Java library that does these. And there you have a nice API where you can go, I want to have my precision for this value like with 0.99. So you can have like a very high precision, but then obviously you need more memory. But then if it doesn't matter to you, you can go down. You can say, I'm fine with a 70% or any float number you think of. You can say what the precision of the estimated value should be. So like, and that's like for min sketch, it's like the amount of hash functions and the amount of like how big is your table where you map to. And then you have, and he showed some other algorithm, which is the membership test. That's the Bloom filter, where you go, is this item in my set?
Bloom filter, I heard.
Yeah, and so many databases nowadays use these Bloom filter for make the set test.
Yeah.
Is it in the set?
Where you can say, if it says true, then it might be in there. But if it says it's not in there, then it's 100% not in there.
Yeah.
Or was it the other
I don't
way
believe the 100%. So it's set in theory, and it's a very high like 99.99999, which still it is a probability. So the probability that the 0.00001 case occurs does occur. It's not that it's not occurring, but Murphy's anyways, law. Well, it's probability. So there is a certain, there's always be a probability that this might not work. But yeah, you get very good assurance that, that this will work for the probability things you set to configure the library to work with. So you, he was like, the Bloom filter is set testing, the count min sketch is like counting like a lot of values with like way less space. And I have like also like I ran through, I don't know, 10 million items in my test, and I used, I don't know, 10 to 20 megabytes with my, like, I, for some reasons I implemented this min sketch thingy by myself, but I want to switch my code now to actually use this library because it's way easier to just go, I want to have this precision. I just added like two hash functions. Of course, I don't use much memory then, blah, blah, blah.
That's a good thing about libraries.
Yeah, yeah. But also like to understand the topic, it's sometimes it's a good idea to, if it's not taking you forever. I didn't heard of Momo hash, for instance. So you have this Guava library from Google, and it has like itself has a min sketch, but it also has like these hash functions called Momo hashes that have these properties that you want. And I never heard of them. Now I use them, and they are pretty easy and simple. And but blah, blah, blah.
I just realized maybe we should take some one step back and why do we want this again? Why do we want to have this heavy hitter algorithm in place?
Because we maybe have we have some company that has a huge stream of data coming into it, for instance, with Kafka. And you see a lot of data, but you want to have like, you want to have a fast and cheap way to roughly know the numbers for a certain kind of thing in your data stream.
Like, I would say we have log data and we have or Twitter feeds.
Yeah, or we have like a microservice architecture where we have a lot of application reporting and we want to see who is busy. Like we go, what are the top K applications contributing to my data stream right now, like to my log metrics thingy.
And can I go deeper as well and say, okay, I don't want only to filter on the name of the application that is reporting, but also on the severity, for instance, or
no, that's the disadvantage. These structures just like they don't. You need to have then other data structures that handle the payload for you. This will only give you, you have this item, I hash it for you, and if you call me back on this particular item, I give you back the thingy. So the count min sketch itself is just like a hash map where you go top 4K, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 1 million, 5 million, 6 but million.
Doesn't it depend on the hash function? Couldn't I have a slightly more complex hash function that not only takes into account the app name, but also the severity or something
Yeah,
else?
So that's what Heavy Hitters does. It takes like you have this count data structure where you have your counts, and then you have another data structure where you go for this count, actually the string is this, and you update this two together. Mm. And there you can also have, of course, another key value store somewhere or a hash map in your memory where you store off like other data. But then this always goes to the cost of like consumption of memory.
Yeah. Or I have to have a little piece before that aggregates the relevant keys to one string. So let's say I have app name and severity, and then I have app name underscore severity, and this is, and you have, you hit a string that you were.
Yeah, you can do that, of course. And it like it's relatively cheap with regard to the input, right? Because, well, if you go now and hash megabytes, it will take forever to hash the megabyte, but yeah, you can do this string concatenation, that will work. But it's not like a database. It's not like anything. It should be very cheap to add these, so you can have like 100 or 1,000 running and make these with just very less memory. And it's like also the cost of hashing should be almost linear to the input size. So
And then you can have alert on different of this
yeah, you would then thing. Yeah, I
you
was
say, okay, I have a heavy hitter for app name, I have a heavy hitter for something else, and then I have maybe 50 heavy hitters And on the output of this heavy hitters, I can say, okay, if this is high and this is low and this is high and this is low, then...
And then we come into the topic of complex event processing, where I listened to a talk about from the Flink guys.
That's a segue, right?
Yeah, I want to like just briefly mention the third algorithm he showed that was hyperloglog, which is a cardinality estimation. So you can
tell me about this one day.
Yeah. So if you want to, like, it's a bit hard to think of it, but if you take, like, you have certain items and you want to have top K, you want to count a certain window of stuff, like 10, hundreds, you want to count them all. But then maybe you want to see how many rows are in my table. And you don't care if it's if it has a certain error to it. You just want to have this answer very quickly.
All right, well, come again. I didn't.
So say we have a table users and we are very popular and we have a trillion users.
Yeah.
If you use a hyperloglog for counting the table, you don't have to do a full table scan anymore. You just estimate the value. And it's a very weird math behind it, and I couldn't follow him. He tried to explain it, but I think he also didn't understand it quite well. It's just like this. This thing in my organization has roughly the dimension, or is like in the tenth of thousands. It's like in the millionth of. It's in the trillions for kind of these vague estimates about how big is a set.
So the order of magnitude.
Yeah, order of magnitude is probably better. Yeah, so you can very fast get the order of magnitude for a certain set of and things.
How do you know roughly how it works?
It's new. The good thing is like you have many libraries supporting this. Even Redis, you can like add a hyperloglog, and then throw like put endlessly into the hyperloglog, and then you ask it again, and it will say, oh, this is like in the order of blah blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
Redis has this Elasticsearch behind the scenes use this for some type of aggregation. I think it's a percentile aggregation, but I don't know for sure. It estimates also.
Okay.
And that makes certain applications really fast or like prevent the count one by one by one thingy. So you go from linear n complexity to constant hash. One like a constant time to do these operation, and that's a big optimization. But then you should always be aware that this is also like it has an error to it, but you can trade the error, so you can use more space, and it's like the certainty is kind of vague.
That's the title of all this big data stuff, right? So in university, the first couple of semesters, you learn that n equals np is never going to work, and we can compute everything, and there is a complexity to everything. And then the longer you are in the business, they say, yeah, it's not solvable, but if we don't care so much about a certain error, then bam, it worked. It works.
Yeah.
Kinda. Okay.
I think that's just too... It takes forever nowadays. Because we cannot fit everything into one. I think this all would change once we ran into quantum computing, because then this is like a new, now vertical scaling is no problem anymore. So we can go endlessly fast with endlessly space, and then all the algorithms will change. Now we have just, we need to parallelize, we need to have core. Amdahl's law will always kick us, so we won't get any faster by parallelizing more. And then we go back and say, we estimate.
Yeah.
And
I mean, it's a lazy ass. I really like this approach, we estimate. I mean, that's the 80-20 rule from last time anyway, right? So
Roughly. Almost.
Almost finished it.
That reminds me then about like we watched this Top Gear episode where they rant about Italian cars and Alfa Romeos. And it was they do great cars that work. Roughly. So Italians made cars that work roughly. Well,
my boss in the apprenticeship times, he always said, yeah, but I have to translate it. Es ist zu 100% fast fertig, so
It's almost done for. No, it's 100% done almost.
It's 100% done. Almost.
So the second talk was real-time analytics with Flink and Druid. And Druid.
What is Druid?
It's another Apache Druid open source project. And I was really annoyed by the speaker. And I was like, I felt kind of...
Who was it?
Sorry for him. Like, I don't know, he was maybe 8 years old, just finished school, diapers, everything. I mean, it's tough, right? You have the stage, sure, and there are like, I don't know, a couple hundred people listening to you, and you can get very nervous.
And you care about what you say.
Yeah, and it's important for you, and yeah, and that's all. And if you get all shaky, that happens, but then still, as a like listening person, it's kind of annoying. And what made me sad is like he's like running or working in a startup that does nothing else but analyzing your cookies and do ad targeting. So all these young
people,
all these young people
wasting their time, in the advertisement business.
I mean, it's not advertisement business; it's spying on your computer.
It's spying advertisement business.
You shouldn't care if I go auto scout and watch the cars I cannot afford for like a million times. That's my private thingy. He got the buzzwords wrong and using like Lambda architecture and Kappa architecture and meshed it all together. And then this droid thingy seems to be like, it's an OLAP cube. So an N-line analytic, online analytic platform data store where you put like anything in and then get some, I don't know, BI stuffy out of it. They basically describe how they wrote a whole lot of code to just get data from HDFS through Kafka into Droid and then make that somewhat fast, but then not really fast because they don't care, because it was weird. And I felt sorry for the guy. So if you have an OLAP cube and you use an OLAP cube, maybe just stay with what you have. It was not like a big, you need to use this for anything. Then there was the stream processor as a database building online applications directly on streams with Apache Flink and Apache Kafka. That was like, whoa, yeah, I'm gonna go there. And nice overview about Flink and what you can do.
Wait. We have some interference. Can you listen to your headset? Is it tapes rolling?
Tapes rolling, yeah.
Some sorry guys.
Minor technical issues.
Yeah, so I don't know shit about GarageBand, obviously.
No, it's I think it's the mistake of the programmer who did the filter thingy.
Yeah.
It's written in C++, and shame on Apple for still using Objective-C and pointers and shit. So stream processor. So this was like a guy from, I think it's like actually the leading contributor of Flink.
Is it this Tim?
I'm bad with names, but he was the only guy who was not wearing diapers and who had like some like meaningful expressions and like good language and good style in his
I think he talked at the FOSDEM in the track that I was in.
I think I saw him also
on Intil.
Yeah,
anyway, I
should have written down the names. Anyways, like it's the same thing. So Flink is a stream processing library with the distinction that it can do batch and it can do streaming, and it's still like splitting these apart. In the opposite, like Spark is using micro-batching and only micro-batching, and you can then configure the batch size of this micro-batch, so you can make it, I guess, bigger. Then they do the same thing where you have like an interv or a DSL that is very common to what we have now with Java 8 and what's long there with Scala. It's and even the func tools in Python, like map, filter, aggregate, group by some of these common functions that then compile down to a direct acyclic graph, where you like, and this is then code that gets executed by the runtime. So it's the same thing with a MapReduce job or a Spark job, you create some code on your side, you run it locally with a local cluster, and then you test it a bit, and then you give it to the cluster, and it will be executed there for with Yarn or the old task manager or whatever. And so that's the whole thingy, which is like then different to Kafka Streaming API, which I will then come later to. Then they work on a feature called Queryable State. Like, if you do stream processing, you can do a whole lot of stuff, like, for instance, what we said with min sketch algorithm. But then the question is always, like, when you look at a window for your stream, like, say, a time window of 10 minutes, how do you get access to the information that you have? It's nice that you can map, transform, send it somewhere. How do you make this current state where you look at queryable so that you can ask, like, with what kind of syntax? That this is an unanswered question yet. Everybody's working on that. But
so you mean the window that you're currently aggregating on,
yeah,
which is not finished yet,
yeah,
that you can query this?
Yeah, normally, like in Storm, you had like some Storm then added to it because they figured out, okay, we want to actually query our current state. So they made an implementation where you can have like a queryable mem store, and you normally they would use something like Redis or Memcache. So your stream, your current window, sends a whole lot of data over the network to another key value store and stores something for you, and then you would query that data store with the specific language of that data store for the results your stream processor is just emitting.
Mm.
But this has the disadvantage that you need to firstly go over the network. Secondly, you may flush or overrun your data store because it can't keep up with the amount of data. Basically, with the Twitter example, you use this huge stream processor infrastructure to crunch down a number, and you can store this one number, but if it's still like you introduce a new bottleneck, because if your cache cannot cope with the amount of data you're sending it, or your network, there's no point in like doing it. It's still like, that's also critique.
Yeah, and having this in a distributed manner and queryable, that seems to be the weird thing, right? I mean, if you have a Twitter stream and you can hook into the stream and have five parallel aggregators for a window of 5 minutes, then they can count on their own. And at the end, they will just merge their result, right?
But yeah, if there is no such query language or kind of like, it's not like solved
yet.
Yeah,
they just aggregate it at the end. So that's the easy part. But if you want to aggregate it at any given point in time, then you have to make sure that it's synchronized.
And that's actually pretty cool. If you go like, there is a certain, they now introduce, or now it's a bit older maybe too, you can have like a moving window, which goes one by one by one by one by one all over time to the right. Then you can have, I forgot the name, but then you have like 10 minutes and then it will shift just 10 minutes further.
Sliding window and...
Yeah, the other one. Yeah, I forgot. There are three modes of like these, how you want to window, do windows. But all of the, like Flink, and like they do these windowing, but they try to work on like how to query it. Then Flink has a lot of APIs related to graph processing, also probabilistic data structures. It has a whole lot of stuff to it, which I think it's kind of too complex for me. And I think it's nothing easy and simple at all. It's just way too much for me. And I don't see how they can make the argument where they go, oh, you don't need any Hadoop stack more and we are way better, but then showing in the architecture slides Yarn and HDFS. You still would need to install a whole lot of stuff. You need to run it. You need to like operate it and write software for it. And
I think attended a Flink workshop last year. I think it was last year. And as I do it all, as always, I attended this workshop. It was one Saturday or so. And then they introduced all this stuff. And while they're introducing it, I containerized it. Like, okay, Let's do it in a container. And if you have like a single instance of Flink, it was easy. But once I wanted to distribute it and make multiple instances in a cluster or in a Docker on a Docker host, then you have the same issue as in most Java projects I encounter, that the internal IP, you have this knotted network, right? If you have 5 Docker hosts, Docker containers on your host, then they have an internal network with which they communicate, and then they have an external IP address and a knotted port or whatever, or an exposed port. And this knotted network always introduce problems. Like, they want to propagate or advertise the IP that they bind to, and they can only bind to one IP. And so I was not able, because this Akka library in Java or whatnot, that was not coping with it, because it wanted to bind on a specific IP, and I had to...
I'm a Java developer.
Yeah,
what,
anyway.
What is a network? I have a Socket API. That's good enough.
But this is
external IP addresses. I mean, what?
Yeah, that bothers me.
I kill myself. Unexpected socket out of memory exception. No, it's a really it's a design flaw.
Yeah.
Now you can with the new APIs, you get these bind host thingy, and if you get lucky and you do it right, you. If you bind to any, 0000,
you do this.
But most APIs didn't expose this setting at all. So you just bind to what's...
Yeah, and most, 5 applications that I know, maybe.
Dukai.
they use this IP that they bind to propagate to others. Oh, this is my IP. So you cannot bind to 0000, because then they will propagate. Oh, by the way, you can reach me under 0000, and then they say, okay, I'll try, but I will fail because it's not an IP, stupid. So that's weird. But anyway,
it's a design flaw, actually.
I think I will retire, move to a Caribbean island, and then write something and go. Bam.
I just vanished. No.
Anyway. Okay, cool.
I know how your book will go. Go for the impatient chapter 1. And then I repeat myself. Go for the impatient chapter 1.5. I repeat myself. Go for the impatient. Go for the impatient. That's how your code will read.
Damn it.
Yeah. No, it's it's problematic. And yeah, I don't know what these Flink guys are up to. It seems to be you need to be aware of what you're doing. I guess if you have everything installed already, almost, you can just add 1 or 2 features, and then you have a nice access to some APIs. But
I think what I like about Flink so far, what I had seen so far, is that they have a lot of connectors to different backends. So you not only rely on Kafka, you can have queries to graph databases and such. But maybe that's a flaw as well, because if you have a lot of different use cases you want to supply, then it's most likely that you do not supply any use case.
One guy wrote, I don't understand all this hype about stream processors, which I think refers to Flink. I'm happy that ZeroMQ solves all my problems. And that's just basically it. You want to move fast stuff, and you're a capable programmer, and you understand your problem, you just want to have a tiny library that you understand that does your thingy, and then you work and move on.
Yeah, but
the other stuff is I have my Excel sheet, I'm a manager, I want to add Flink and do a whole weird stuff of thingies that I don't really understand. I want to have these magical black boxes that do big data. And that's nothing else for me than saying this. For the academics, it's maybe also a nice project, because these are very talented kids. It's just that they are kids and never ran into any real business situation yet, or ran into a real pragmatic use case where they had the decision to make trade-off. They just write Scala code as hell and add features, and it's rocking. But then it's beside the point. And that's...
I would like to distance myself a little bit from Hagen from time to time. Yeah, we are lucky that we only only listen to our podcast ourselves, because it's a little bit offending how you...
Oh,
but yeah. I mean, this is how you feel, then it's how you feel. But it's... I mean, they are patient, I guess, about their...
Well, it's just about they are passionate, and that's all cool, and that's all nice, and everybody and like is passionate about their baby and stuff, and that's cool. It's just if you're like in your mid 20s and you just finish university and you start a startup, you probably don't have a lot of experience what's on the market. You just saw your studies, and now you have like you learned programming, and now you start stuff, and it's just that you never like. It's natural that you get your wise or wisdom like a little bit later once you saw a lot of different stuff coming and going and see how the whole circus is working. Yeah. And if you just stand there, and I was the same with 25, I was doing this podcast startup, burning millions, literally, and got nowhere. Yeah. Not that I say that that's happened to everybody. I'm not saying that. It's just that I was like all excited about it, and now I'm 10 years older and I have a different view to that.
Yeah, I had my own startup as well. Yeah. We tried to be YouTube for music.
Yeah.
And I'm still not a millionaire.
Why not?
Yeah, I don't know. Didn't work out. Yeah. Music business.
So that's the saddest point of this podcast. We have both failed our startups and we are jealous about everybody else.
Yeah, that's it. If they have success...
nobody should have success. No, that's not what I mean. I think there are use cases for Flink. It's just that I'm happy that I'm not touching that right now.
Yeah. Then, okay. Moving on,
we had Apache Lucene 6. What's coming next? So this is Uwe Schindler, a well-known guy in the Lucene community. Always good to listen to. He knows everything, the whole commit history and what features were up and running. He is like responsible for the amazing test suite of Lucene and interesting.
Give me a 2 or 3 sentence introduction to Lucene. I mean, if you do not know what Lucene is.
Yes, Lucene is a search library where you can implement search scenarios, and it's written in Java and it's very fast, and it's there for a long time. At this point, I always like to have the project at hand to see what their baseline is. Lucene Apache
provides Java-based indexing and search technology, as well as spell checking, hit highlighting, and advanced analytics tokenizing capabilities.
Yeah. Scalable high-performance indexing, over 150 gigabyte per hour on modern hardware, small RAM requirements, only 1 megabyte of heap.
Okay, so you can push data to it, and it will analyze, tokenize it, and index it.
And then you have query language to query the index.
And it will also store it?
Yeah. So you can have, like, you define basically a document, and within that document you define fields, and in that fields you say how the data should be analyzed. And there is also like the option to just store what it saw. So you give it a string and you say, please analyze it. It's an English thing. Remove certain types of words, for instance, stop words, high frequently words. And then it will put this into an index structure. And if you say store, it will just go and store this raw data for you. So if you query it, you can get not only what you index, but also what you store. So that's mostly what you want. It's like
Lucene core. So what you just described, you need JSON or you need strings?
No, that's a pure Java library. That's a you just like you need to write what's going in and what's going out. So Elasticsearch and Solr use these library to build like a bigger, more convenient search engine.
But so Lucene can use bytes. Just bytes?
That's what it does, right. It just sees everything as bytes.
Ah, okay. And Solr on top sees everything as JSON?
Yeah, Solr comes from XML, but yeah, you can use JSON nowadays with Solr and like Elasticsearch too. But
And Elasticsearch sees everything as JSON, right?
Yeah.
Internally, at least.
No.
Oh, damn it.
They have done something they called X content. And yes, they pass, like, they expect everything to be sent as JSON. And then they do something of their own there. They use standard Java JSON libraries to, like, encode and decode JSON. But internally, they have some other optimizations for them to work through.
But so, it's a recent development. Before they use JSON, or do they use this?
No, it was from the beginning. They expose a JSON API, like everything talking to Elasticsearch is JSON. But then internally, if you see the Java code, it goes, parses a JSON, and then shifts objects around. They call it X content.
Yeah, it doesn't.
That's
make
just
sense,
a,
right?
Yeah, it's just hidden from you.
Because you do not want to store JSON, because you have to decode, encode, unmarshal.
It's like also because the overhead. Way they send, they make a lot of network communication, and to optimize for that with Java, they do this kind of stuff. Okay. It's perfectly fine, and it's almost always hidden from you. But when you have to hit it, it's kind of weird how they handle it.
Okay, so Lucene is the underlying technology that does the storing and sees everything as bytes.
And builds this index structure and takes care about like the counting, for instance. You can do these aggregations. That's now, like, it was a feature in Solr and Elasticsearch, which was built on top of it. Now with the contributors, they get it down into the Lucene core libraries. You have numerical search.
Solr and Elasticsearch are on the same level, or is Elasticsearch built on Solr as well?
No. So Solr and Elasticsearch are both built on top of Lucene. It's just that because Solr is also an Apache project, it happens almost always if Lucene releases a new version, a new Solr version will immediately come out, use the new Lucene version. Okay. While Elasticsearch is not run by the Apache Foundation, but by Elastic, it's not that, I wouldn't say it lags behind, because there are some technical debt in Solr, which has not been removed in the last years or so, but it takes a while. If you have a huge code base and you do all the stuff that Elasticsearch provides you, you will need some time to integrate all these new features. There's massive refactoring maybe going on. So it takes some time.
But I haven't used Solr, to be honest. Is it also storing, or is it just?
It's also storing. It's like it looks. It's hard to tell. Well,
but what's the difference between Solr and Elasticsearch then?
The first difference was once it came out that Elasticsearch is built for distributed search, so it's very easy to cluster it. It's very easy to add new indexes. Split by shards, do rolling indices.
Yeah.
Solr was always like a single HTTP thingy, like a server that uses Lucene, has one index, you put it on there. In the former days, you would also run it like you only get the jar, and then you run it in a Tomcat, for instance, or you run it with the embedded Jetty inside. That was then more common. And then when Elasticsearch was like skyrocketing, they decided to come up with something they call Solr Cloud, where they use Zookeeper and then connect a whole lot of like Java processes talking via Zookeeper to build a cluster. And then you could also like have APIs to add new indices and then split in indices and index.
Sounds like enterprise software.
Yeah, it was kind of like, yeah, it was early on. Like Elasticsearch came later and had like other ideas.
And learned from Solr, I guess.
Maybe. But no, it was like really a different approach. That I think that it's honest to say that Elasticsearch was really new. Now, if you like, I don't know, 2 or 3 years later, it's hard to tell what the features it is. So if you ran a cluster and you all your developers are fine with Zookeeper and you know all this stuff, then Solr Cloud is like no problem for you. But if you don't know it and you don't want to care about all this stuff, I think it's way easier to use Elasticsearch. Saying this, some stuff like in speed comparison, there are certain types of features that are faster in Solr than they are in Elasticsearch.
Okay.
But then the ease of use also differs massively. I think Solr is too complex. But
Elasticsearch, you can download, start, and then just use it. And as a developer, if it's one Elasticsearch instance or 100, there's no big difference to you as a developer, right? Anyway, okay. But we were talking about Lucene, the newest version, right?
Yeah, so the new features are... I hope I get this right. I think I edit the in-between. So it's now using JDK 8 completely. It... by default, it will now use a new scoring algorithm. So this is the sorting. Once you have a query, all documents get sorted by the relevance, right? And the relevance value is a value that needs to be computed. And before Lucene 6, that was called TF-IDF, which is like term frequency and the averse document frequency. And worked perfectly fine. And there is another algorithm out that's called BM25, which was explained by Britta Weber in another talk, which is kind of interesting. But like, the outcome is basically the performance of the algorithm is just only a slightly bit better than what we had before. And yeah, somehow they decide to switch now. But it wasn't clear to me why, because it seems that the overall performance of the scoring is not really like that much better. But the complexity to the algorithm, from my understanding, it's way higher. So I don't understand this trade really. But now we need to... If you like, when I was a search consultant, it was always easy and intuitive to explain why these documents get ranked according to this query. Because you could go, these are the amount of terms you have here, and these are words that are like important for this document, but not for everyone. So this makes sense to you. So I could explain it intuitively why this query scores. With BM25 now, the algorithm is really more complex, and you... there's an estimation to it, and then there are some assumptions that are not so intuitive to explain anymore. And it's not faster to compute. Like I ask, and I think they don't get a speed gain for computing now. I really don't understand why they switched that.
Yeah, because if it's a black magic, then it's easier to consult on.
Good point. Good point. Yeah.
It's like SEO. It's yeah. Black magic.
Then there are new tools which kind of like, if we now, and that should also be like, this should be, that's noteworthy. If you have like, if you started using Lucene indices and you have now indices over the years, like that's a common pattern that you add new indexes by time slides, like daily indexes,
yeah,
or monthly.
Like Logstash does it.
Yeah. So if you have these and you have this ongoing for years with a new switch and the new Lucene 6, you would need to re-index the data, because if you open with the Lucene 6 version a 2-year-old index, it won't be backwards compatible. They did this from 3 to 4, I guess, and now they did it again. So from 4 to 6, there are tools where you can go and like Lucene will try to automatically do it for you. So once you open it, it will say and give a warning, I need to do some service work here for you to change your index structure to be compliant with my version. But maybe it encounters a problem and then will fail. And then you have another tool where you can run manually and say, here's a directory for the index. And that would be a command line tool that you just call, and that will then like migrate your old index to a new version.
Okay.
So it might happen that you go back in time for some reasons and won't be able to read your index data before you, like, because you didn't adopt it.
Okay, and Lucene 6 is the underlying technology for the latest Elasticsearch, or is Elasticsearch still on Lucene 5?
I guess I missed that talk. I don't know when they will, like, I think it's in Elasticsearch 5. They will now jump from version 2 to 5, and then Logstash, Kibana, and Elasticsearch will all called Elastic 5.
Yeah.
And that's all together, and that's, they will all have the same version.
Sounds like a Marvel comic, right? Elastic 5.
Elastic 5, yeah. Do they have 5 products?
Kibana, Elasticsearch, Beat. Then they have, I think they have, it's like this tick stack from InfluxDB, from InfluxData, like, no, InfluxDB they call. They have like a store, an analytics anomaly detection thingy, dashboard or a graph library.
Oh, and there's Shield from Elasticsearch. That would Shield. Be four.
And Watcher?
Is that from Elastic?
I think it was.
Let's yeah, I think it doesn't matter because in Christmas time they will come up with Elastic 6 and then they won't. Like, yeah.
But I think Elastic 5 is just the fifth version. I mean, Kibana 4 we have already and yeah. Kibana 5 and then they will push up everything to 5.
Yeah, it's business.
Beats, Watcher, Shield, Marvel, Graph. Yeah.
Yeah, I also talked briefly. I got to stay aside one Elastic developer who was...
Okay, rolling again.
Yeah, so they were talking about this Elasticsearch graph feature, and they, just to be sure that everybody's on the same page, they actually don't store a graph. They do this via the existing query infrastructure, so you can have certain types of aggregation, and they build upon that. So you won't have, like for instance, in Neo4j or other graph databases, like all your data stored in a graph structure. That's not the case with Elastic Graph. It's just the convenience that for certain type of queries, you get documents and you have a graph-like way to navigate through them and query them in a certain like. Nearest neighbor can also be explained as like a shortest path, but that I think that's vague and way too buzzy. And the important part is Elasticsearch is not going to be a graph database.
Mm-hmm.
that's just not.
It just has some graph features or graph-like features.
Yes,
but it supports some stuff that you might expect from a graph database.
Yes. And then that's it.
So I won't move from Neo4j to Elastic.
I'm polite today, right?
Yeah.
It's a trigger warning for me, right? Because like it's a trigger. I wouldn't like Neo4j. I'm polite today. So yeah, you would stay with Neo4j, but then.
Yeah, for my sandbox. Graph database development.
For your graph that copes with three nodes.
Yeah.
And nine edges.
It's just for now, it's just playing around with it a bit and pushing it from left to right.
Oh, cool.
It's not scaled.
Yeah, and then there was a talk about parallel SQL and streaming expressions in the Apache Solr 6. So this is like the new Solr release based upon Lucene 6. And that was weird. Because they, for some reasons, they introduced like a streaming API. They want to do SQL over MapReduce. And that was also a pattern through the whole conference. Once, like, everything is stream processing now. And the second part is, like, everybody introduces an SQL-like query language. And then that's, like, so weird. Because this whole buzzword thingy started off of not only SQL trend, like new databases and data solutions, and now everybody is talking about getting back to the query thing of SQL, and that's so weird.
No SQL, then it was not only SQL,
and now it's like back to SQL, and that's a bit crazy. If you have these kind of like that was like I don't know, I can't really think about having the problem space right now, or who of my former clients would have problems they want to, and I don't understand. You have a search engine. You basically what you do is you throw text at it and you query it. That's a search engine. I don't understand why you want to have a search engine that has SQL like query capabilities and can do streams. I really don't. I think that I don't know. Maybe I'm old fashioned, but I think I could use my own code to do streams. I can use ZeroMQ. I can do Kafka. There's a million solutions out there. Why would I want my search engine to have streaming capabilities? I don't know. I didn't get it, basically. But it's out there. They work on it. They will release it. All cool. Next thing is introducing Kafka streams. And that was one developer from Kafka, Confluent.io. a Kafka developer who works for Confluent.io lives in Switzerland, actually. So we could talk in German, but nice stuff. I'm a huge fan of that, actually, and I would recommend also buying the book about Kafka. And
but what are we talking about?
It's Kafka, the append log, distributed append log, storage solution, maybe, if you want to call it.
Okay.
They just call it append log. And they added a new feature to their append log where you could process the append log as stream and do operations on that stream.
And then like having an inline samsa or something, like you have a topic where you push messages to, and then you have a constant query to this or constant.
Yeah, that's consumer. Also not solved, right? So Kafka also not solves the problem of queryable streaming state. That's not solved. You just have an API now where you can go and write, see, I want to have this topic and I subscribe to this topic and then I want to join these by blah, blah, blah. And I want to do these kind of transformation. And then I store this into a third topic, which with my results. The nice thing about it that is that you only have a jar as a dependency. You write your code, you build a jar, and you run your jar, and you scale your jar by just running more instances of that jar.
Yeah.
And that's all very simple and basic stuff.
Yeah.
And also the features and streams, it's not like they reinvented the wheel or have now a stream processor, blah, blah, blah. It's they just using their existing consumer groups, and the consumer group feature is already featured with stuff like some consumer goes down, I need to rebalance, I need to manage my offsets in the commit log. And they don't edit a whole lot of like new paradigms to Kafka. They just use what's there to make it fault tolerant and resilient and everything. And that's basically consumer groups. They just make it now available through a nice API, which goes new stream processor, and then you go subscribe, and then join, and you can also have aggregates and the data transformation features. So
it sounds a little bit like an integrated light samsa.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, because the only thing that I did not completely understand or understood.
If you're not understanding it now, then it's also understand.
Good point. It's like you have these aggregates, right? And that's like 10 minutes. That's a time window on your stream. So you aggregate over a certain time window. And while you're doing this and you want to aggregate, you need state. You need to have like a variable, like in the simplest case, you want to count.
Yeah.
So you have a variable somewhere, and then say your job fails, hardware crashes, blah, blah, blah. What's happening? So they do the same with like Samza does, is like your state locally will be replicated to a Kafka topic for that kind of like consumer.
So a cache topic for this.
Yeah, it will always be there. And then when your job dies, it can be replayed to the current state it were, and then go on with that. But this state, this local state, you can like use the heap, like just make a hash map or some Java-like data structure on your memory, or you can use RocksDB. And that's very similar to what Samza does.
Okay.
So it's very inspired by Samza. It's just that Samza would also need you to, like, you get your jar and you have everything written down with Samza. You need to deploy it to your yarn.
No.
No.
I created a Samza container that I just started. I mean, yarn is just the means to schedule it, right? It's yet another resource negotiator. But you could also schedule this with Swarm, I think. That's what I would do, but
Yes, I agree that Samza, but you can have other schedulers, right?
Yeah. And but Yarn, they use Yarn because Yarn is in the area.
But then how would you like, Yarn is there.
Yeah, but you could also deploy it to a Swarm cluster and then say, if this node
and
dies,
they would
this
also like
dies,
share their workloads between each other. So you have one container that goes, I subscribe to my log topic, and you have, and you want to scale that specific job, and then you say, my log transformation SAMSA program, scale 10. What would happen? Because they need to exchange their different offsets for like consuming from one topic, transform it, and then be all on the same page so that they don't like read the same data.
Hmm.
I think there's something to it when doing it with Yarn that this type of stuff gets handled.
Maybe. But
but I don't know for sure. But
that's a dangerous semi-knowledge from my side.
Yeah, and that would be easier in German. nice also that they said because of like adoption throughout developers, they will refocus back to Java. It's nice, like it's nice to have Scala to do certain types of programs and features that Java does not provide, and a type system and everything that Java doesn't provide. But then for the external view, for all the developers in the world, it's way easier to just provide a Java API because the interop from other GVM languages with Java itself, it's way easier and like out of the scope of Kafka or Confluent IO. So they will only expose Java, not only, but they will like focus more on the Java API again to be more like easier adoptable for other developers. I think that makes a lot of sense and was quite happy about that. Because if you want to use Scala, you still have the Scala API. If you want to use JRuby or Clojure or something else on the GVM, you just use the Java API and build your usual special language thingy around it. But Confluent IO or Kafka doesn't do it for you. And that way it's simpler. It's just this thingy and one API.
And the Scala API stems from the Java API, yeah, the early day, the other way around.
What I didn't know, or maybe I could have known, is when LinkedIn started the Kafka project, it was their first big project where they tried to use Scala. So like the very oldest code of Kafka looks exactly like Java, just written in Scala. So they, because the developers learned Scala by writing Kafka. That's interesting.
But that's how you learn it best.
Yeah. Then I think that was, yeah, the last talk of day one was from Yelp. You know these guys, I think.
Yelp.
And they talked about the logging pipeline with Apache Kafka. And it's just like, it was not really interesting. Basically, the same old story of a startup that does stuff, fails on it because technical debt and too fast moving, too agile, and then die on technical debt with one solution and then come up with a new solution. But they did made some nice remarks regarding Kafka monitoring. So you want to, or Kafka monitoring, Kafka running Kafka in production, basically. So you want to measure producer latency, the probability, the time out for producers, the producer measures per second, the producer lag, the consumer lag, sorry, not the producer lag, the partitions that are offline, the under-replicated partitions, the controller count, and the messages per day, and something like that. I'm weird here with my topic point. But I think that's very interesting for everybody who's like running Kafka. Maybe you have this already in place or you're just working on it. It's cool to see when another company provides you, we do this for monitoring, and that way we assure that everything runs fine. So you can do this and maybe do some extra stuff where you think you need to take care about this. But if we all agree, like it's the same for Elasticsearch, if we all agree we need to measure this and this and this for like...
As a baseline monitoring.
As a baseline monitoring to see how our cluster does. And I think it's very valuable. It's a, like, yeah, with everything, you need to take care about the quorum. So how many of your broker can go down until you really lose messages. Yeah, with Zookeeper in place in Kafka, you can be like, it's, I think it's Paxos. So you can be sure that in the quorum case where you like where you are in your quorum, where you made sure so many instances I allow to fail out, I'm not losing messages. This is like true once you use your cluster management with Zookeeper. So that's fine and you're on the safe side. But you need to, like, obviously you want to decide, okay, I got this much data, I have this much hardware, I partition my topic into this amount of partitions and I have a replication factor of X, blah, blah, blah. It's still not like a very simple calculation. And once you scale, you want to change this. And
Yeah. Okay.
Nice story. I think I would end here with day one because day two is probably the same length and we are already
1 hour in, I think.
Yeah. And you are tired. You fall asleep almost.
No. I'm not. But do you think that we should split it in the second? Oh, but it's still fresh, the buzzword thing, right? So yeah, then let's go jump into the second tile.
The second, like, yeah, I got beers with my friends on Monday evening, and was nice talking and discussing, but too many beers, too many beers, because beer is countable, right, if you drink it in glasses.
Yeah. That's true.
Otherwise, it would be too much.
If you directly bring it from the tap.
Yeah, it's too much then.
It is too much.
Yeah. So now the second day was data streaming architecture with Apache Flink. And that was like, yeah, very young speaker. And like, yeah, it's a bit of like what we had before. And yeah, you're falling asleep, my friend. Then I was like running high performance.
I will grab another coffee.
And I talk alone or what?
Yeah, no, I listen to you because I have this Bluetooth headset. So
just really?
I will listen to you.
I think that's a complete novum in a podcast.
That's an agile podcast.
So you know these other radio guys who have their microphone with them and then going to the toilet and doing lines?
Standing in line or yeah. What do you mean?
Yeah, practicing lines on the toilet. Yeah, so I will talk about running high performance. I'm already bored by myself. Running high performance and fault tolerant Elasticsearch clusters on Docker. And Zematex, I like them very much. They do very nice blog posts regarding the GVM and monitoring of GVM-based technologies. And they have good insights and I think they are a great consultancy. But this talk was like just a short talk and briefly catches on Docker and Elasticsearch. And well, it was not that you. Maybe, yeah, I shouldn't have gone there basically. Then another Flink talk about stream analytics and complex event processing, where I think, complex event processing definitely a thing where you want to have a look at when you do your streams because it's about pattern matching and how you would go and say, for this stream, I have this amount of X or an event that occurs with a certain probability. And that also then I have another stream. And if they both occur together, I might want to react on this. And I think that's very interesting. So, but Flink develops also an own language for that, or DSL and Scala, which makes certain stuff easier to use, but then also maybe you won't understand the whole topic. And maybe it's like, maybe your problems are also very easy and you can just use like regular stream processing and what we said before, like probabilistic data structure to measure stuff and then go with a simple rule-based engine that just triggers your, basically it's a rule-based engine on streams. You can have different types of rule-based engines, I guess, and you can, for simple stuff, I think you're better off doing it yourself. But maybe that's just me hyped up on streams and everything. You do all the thing yourself and don't use standard tools. But I think, like, yeah, there's always this trade-off between standard tools and doing it yourself. Yeah, that's another podcast. Then BM25 by Britta Weber. Interesting thingy.
But you talked already about it, right? Isn't it this Lucene thingy?
Yeah. And I just want to mention it again because it comes up here in my notes. Yeah, I talked about it. Basically, I think most of the guys working with Solr and Elasticsearch and do real search applications for real search content, like not logs and metrics and stuff. You want to understand
hey,
this.
Hey, that's also real search.
It's real search. The problem is that our data is mostly structured.
Damn.
And it's like we are not talking about like log language. There's like it's different. And BM25 will probably like will work for our logs just as for this. There's no point in discussing this in the regards of logs. But it, there is a point in doing natural language processing with it because it makes certain assumptions about the language itself. So you want to look at Britta Weber's talk and maybe understand what... Like, she makes a nice job of explaining all the terms in a very complex formula and say where they are stemming from and where they are related to the old model of TF-IDF. And you just want to go through that. So once you talk to a customer, you are able of to you are able to do some explanation. It will be not intuitive, though.
Do I need to know the first algorithm as well? It's TIF.
TF-IDF.
Yeah. What does it stand for? Is it an acronym?
Term frequency divided by the inverse document frequency.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fancy.
Yeah, it's fancy, but it's still simple. It is very simple, but BM25 isn't. Really.
Are you? I think you explained it. Once we were at the LogarFox,
you yeah. So you count, like in a document, you count the terms, that's the term frequency. You count how often Kniep occurs in the document you are reading. And then you have a certain term frequency for Kniep. And then the inverse document frequency would be something like how often does Kniep occur in this document and not in all the others?
Mm-hmm.
That's the inverse document. That by that you can go for stop words like and, or, when, blah, blah, blah. They occur in every document. So by just counting the term frequency, they would be overly popular. But they don't mean anything really. They don't contribute to your relevance.
Yeah.
So you vote them down, you're giving them a negative weight, or other in like important words get a positive thingy because they are unique to this document.
And not
and to the corpus.
Yeah.
And then this is still the same thingy you want to do in BM25. It's just that these numbers, term frequency, is just counting a term, and then the other thing is counting the term in all the documents and make the inverse of it, like divide one by document frequency, and then there's a logarithmus to it. But this is simple stuff, and BM25 it completely isn't, but does the same thing.
Yeah, but I said that's a consultancy pitch.
Yeah, maybe it might be, but yeah, you want to like check this out. The last talk, second day, was in Franz Club. It was not the last talk, but I ran off. I was too tired. Kiwi, KIYVE. That's a key value store that is written in C++. The way it like the underlying data structure of the store is actually a finite state transducer, which need to be looked up, and I won't explain it here. It's like a graph-based structure where you remove redundancy by using a try, and then have like an end state when you found something for the key match. That's not so well explained, though. The interesting part was that it's very, very fast, and it in like you can store like up to 5 terabytes within just one structure, which outperforms the Lucene FST implementation. And he came up with really promising numbers, but he also was very carefully about it and say like you need to do your own performance test, which you always should do. But yeah, if you have like a very beefy machine and a very big one. Or two, I think you can build something really fast, really awesome with this Kiwi stuff, and it's brand new.
How is it pronounced? Key.
It's a key, like key, K I Y, and then V E.
With W or with V?
I'll send it to you. Where are you?
KV. Okay. KV. Ah, okay. KV.
Yeah, and
KV, yeah, okay.
So his problem space starts where Redis is not fast enough for you anymore. So
yeah, that happens to me all the time.
Yeah. So, but yeah, it was very interesting, and he seems to be like a hell of a C++ programmer. But okay, I mean, yeah, that's valid. And oh, I just see, I didn't run off. I did go to the Google Dataflow talk, but then I ran off. And that was a Spanish guy who is now working, like, who works as a developer for Google and now is, like, an evangelist on the cloud services that Google provides. And he was demoing Dataflow, also stream processing, data processing, all in one huge thingy. The guy had a nice, like, presenting style, very, very pro, very, like, fun and well done, basically. Then it's like your data processing pipeline in the cloud, managed everything by Google. You just write a bit of code, Java API, and then you launch this in your thingy, in your Google account, and then Google will do everything for you. And then you get a visualization, you get like a scheduling overview, like where it splits the task and like how one task performs, and then nicely done, nicely UI. But I don't know, as a proprietary company, I don't think so many people will just actually do that. You don't want to go with your like all your business insight and give all the data to Google. I don't see how any company would actually want this. But if you want to try data processing, or your university, or you like, or you're processing open data that are available to everybody, I think that's a very simple. Easy. It's not the same old. I think behind the scenes it's very complex, and because they need to manage, I don't know, also tens of thousands of machines to enable these kind of stuff, and need to route you to the nearest data center and schedule your job and reschedule thingies and solve a whole lot of hard problems. But they did it, and it looks nice, and it has a UI, and it's clicky and shiny, and you can use it. But I guess you wouldn't like, as it like, not in a business case. I don't see the business case here. But nice if you want to check out something, and of course you have then the predict IO or predict engine, so you can run your streams also through like some machine learning classification stuff, and then route this according to your classifier.
Okay.
Well.
Yeah, this big data stuff, we have to talk a lot more about it because I want to know it.
It's very selfish. So that was the second day. After all, I'm really happy about spending only like the Trust Us price, which is like, I think, the half of it. If I would have paid 900 or 1,000 nearly, I think it would not be worth it. Many talks are just too low level, like really like just brief introduction to stuff.
It's called buzzwords, right? So
yeah, you get a lot of buzzwords. That's okay.
Maybe this is an approach, getting the buzzwords out and yeah, but get you some... an overview.
Yeah, what I'm trying to say is that you have a lot of like conferences in Europe where you go from 200 to like 500 and you get a decent, good conference. And I think 1,000 euros is like a mark. You should deliver, I mean, a go-to conference costs 1,000 euros. And the buzzword had definitely not the people, and also not like the variety of topics like a go-to conference.
Mm.
So yeah.
Yeah, maybe, but to defend them, I never went there, but
yeah.
It's like 6-7 years old, you said, right? So when it started, it was very unique, I guess, and now there are so many specialized conferences out there there was always CoreOS Fest here, and you have the Go conferences, and you have very specialized conferences. So maybe yeah, maybe nowadays, if you want to know about a specific topic, you go there. If you want to go this overview, you go there. And since they are so old and known, they just have this premium price. So
maybe, yeah. So all 2 years, I will go with the Trust Us ticket for half the price. And we just go there because it's fun and you see a lot of people and I revisit everybody. And then I guess that's fine. I just wouldn't go for the full price every year. I guess that's my point. Okay, yeah, and I think I'm done. And you can now wake up and pursue normal activity. This podcast is done.
Okay, cool. So do we have any housekeeping stuff to talk about?
Basically, I need to move my thingy that's under my back, a spine, to get these show notes up and running. Like I promised I would do something GitHub related to you, but I didn't do anything.
Yeah, but
we need to get the show notes out there.
Yeah, but to be honest, I mean, I never looked at show notes and I listened to podcasts for a couple of years
but
now.
Sometimes maybe you're interested in a link, but then maybe you also remember just the hot topics, go to this awesome search engine in the interwebs and find stuff.
Yeah, but still, we should have high hopes for ourselves and put out some notes, but I think it's not the most... I mean, maybe... Someone can tell us over Twitter, and our Twitter handles are CQNIB and Sojona. So SOJONER.
Yeah.
Maybe you can tell us. What do you think is more time worthy, like putting out a podcast every week?
Or drinking beer.
No, yeah, drinking beer, but that we can do anyways. make a shiny process out of it, having our descriptions and notes and putting it correctly or just
it's way too much work.
It's NPR to make it right and we make it 100% correct roughly.
Yes.
So you, okay,
maybe we change the title to 80%.
80% roughly. No, 100% almost. Anyway,
80-20.
Okay, cool. So next time, I think we will go for German again, but this time felt better than the first English version we did.
For me too. But I effed it up at the beginning by promoting
Donald
somebody.
Trump.
Well, I just wanted to like shoot now. Nah, okay.
Yeah, but I think what also...
I'm not promoting Donald Trump though. I'm just like, I think it's an awesome election thingy and it's very interesting what's happening.
I'm a bit excited about it. No, I think also what comes in handy for us is that we focus on one topic and not having four different topics. I think it's a very good thing. So today was Berlin buzzwords. Next week will be something else. And
docker,
maybe. But
you cannot hide. You need to come out with it.
Otherwise, I will explode.
Yeah.
No, and I have a workshop at the conference in 2 weeks, so we should talk about Docker before.
Or you talk about the conference then afterwards and skip it. Maybe once you talk about it, we will lose our one listener or two or three.
Yeah. Okay.
We will never talk about
Docker. Let's wrap it up.
goodbye.
Thanks for listening and off we go. Bye-bye.